I want to ask you a serious question. Do you feel a little stuck in your two-person scenes? Do you feel like you're doing the same scenes over and over again, like every scene you do is about a roommate? Well, if you answer yes, then I want to help. And the best way I know how to help you is by letting you know that I will be teaching my two-person scene tune-up one-day workshop on Saturday, December 30th, here in Chicago. I limit this to 14 people, so you get personal attention. To register or for more information, just go to my website at jimmycorain.com. Also, if you're a seasoned improviser, an actor, or new to improv, I just want to let you know I'll be starting my next Artist Low Comedy Level 1 class on January 10th at Green Shirt Studios here in Chicago. I also limit this to 10 people, so you get personal attention. And to register or for more information, just go to my website, jimmycorain.com.
Feral Audio.
Jimmy Corain, Jimmy Corain's a nerd. Jimmy Corain's an improv nerd. Jimmy Corain's a nerd.
Hey everybody, this is Jimmy Corain, and you're listening to another episode of Improv Nerd. And before we get to this episode, I want to talk to you about something I'm very passionate about, and that is laundry and dry cleaning. Now, have you ever thought about laundry and dry cleaning at the tap of a button? Yes, there is an app for that. With Drive, you will get your dry cleaning and laundry picked up, then cleaned, and then delivered by Chicago top cleaners, all through this Drive app. It's available morning, evenings, and weekends. Book your first pickup now. Search Drive, and it's spelled D-R-Y-V in the app stores, or go to drive.com. Now, here's the best part. You will get $20 off. That is $20 off your first order when you use the promo code ImprovNerd. So don't waste any more time. We all deserve to have clean clothes. Go to drive.com, put in the ImprovNerd promo code, and save $20 on your first order today. If you're in Chicago, I want you to check out the Second City Training Center's weekly musical improv show, Infinite Sundays, happening every Sunday night at 8 p.m. in the Blackout Cabaret. Now, a brand new show is performed each week, which will result in a brand new musical. Tickets can be purchased at secondcity.com. Training Center students get in for free. Use the code NERD for $2 off. Go to secondcity.com and use the code NERD for $2 off. And don't forget, if you like what we're doing here on Improv Nerd, go to iTunes. Go to iTunes and write us a positive review. It would really help with my low self-esteem. All right, we have got a great episode of Improv Nerd. No, I'm striking that. We have got a terrific episode of Improv Nerd. You know him as Ehrlich from HBO's Silicon Valley. He is one of the most respected stand-up comedians out there today. He's also been in movies like Cloverleaf, Yogi Bear, Transformers, Deadpool. I am talking about the incredible T.J. Miller. As you know, this is usually a part of the podcast where I say, you know, we talked about this and we talked about that. What we call in the business a little teaser to get you excited to listen to the whole episode. T.J. Miller covered so much ground in such a short period of time. We were all over the place, and he gave us so much great stuff. We talked about physicality in comedy and how important that is to him. We also talked to him about doing stand-up here in Chicago and improv here in Chicago, how he developed his great work ethic, how he came up with the character of Ehrlich, and he demonstrates how he changes his voice to create that character. And we talked to him about his unique approach to acting and auditioning, which I think you're going to find really, really helpful. Before we get to this interview, I just want to say something about persistence. As you know, as you could guess, I don't have much of it at all. I never did. You know, I quit very easily. And especially if I can smell success coming, I'll quit even faster. But for whatever reason, with this interview, it took me about 3.5 years. I had gotten T.J. Miller's email about 3.5 years ago, and I would email him, and he was, and we talk about that in the top of the interview. He always emailed me back and said either he could do it or not, but he really wanted to do it. I just didn't give up, which is such a rarity in my life. I don't know why. I think part of it is because he was so nice about it, and I just said, you know what, I'm just not going to give up until I get a no or a yes. And thank God I got a yes, because he's so much fun, he's so much energy, and I think you're going to find what he has to say so valuable. The other thing he refers to me as a luminary in this interview, and of course, I feel a little ashamed, but what there's not an interview that I've done, and I've done over 200, that I don't feel shame. You know, that's my sense that I've done a good job. That's my little reward. And I wish I would have reacted a little better when he, because it's a compliment. A luminary is a compliment. And I need to keep learning to take compliments better. Enough about me. You need to listen to somebody who's got their shit together, who's super successful, and his star is rising and getting bigger and brighter. Also, I want you just to be aware as you listen to this, we're in a small dressing room at the Annoyance Theater in Chicago, and I have a film crew there, and he has a film crew there, and sometimes during the interview, he will turn to a camera, which you will not be able to see because you're listening. This is, I don't know if you're aware of this, but the podcast is an audio medium. So he'll be looking at that. I just wanted you to be aware of it. Looking at one of the cameras, doing a spit take or saying something to one of the cameras. So if it goes quiet for a second or whatever during this interview, just use that visual in your mind. So here it is. I hope you like it because I was just blown away and just had a great time with it. Here it is, the TJ Miller episode. Enjoy.
Jimmy's a nerd. He's a nerd. Oh, yeah.
For a man who's not afraid of death, I seem to record a lot of my life, yeah.
What do you mean by that, you're not afraid of death?
Well, you know, I mean, a big part of what I'm doing with stand-up right now is trying to talk about death anxiety and meaning and sort of meaninglessness and living in a post-religious, post-meaning society.
Did you experience a death recently?
No, people try and link these two things together, but I had an arterial venous malformation, which is an AVM. It's a congenital disorder that they performed brain surgery on me where I had a 1 in 10 chance of dying. And a lot of people think that's why I talk about death, but it's less that, and it's more, I don't see with comedy, I'm not sure how relevant being political is because you're preaching to the choir, right? And I'm not sure how being socially satirical is really relevant because, again, you're sort of preaching to the choir. So I wanted to sort of go one step past that and look at things that aren't necessarily being talked about, in my opinion, enough, which is like death, meaning, you know.
But you also,
all that existentialist baloney.
Yeah, but
right?
You
ever heard of it?
You kid about it, but you are a big student of Nietzsche. You were a philosophy or a psychology major. So
yeah.
This is an interest that you've always had, I would imagine.
Well, psych major, but I went to a philosophy course in college, and I kind of, everybody was so pretentious and rude, and it was just about what I knew and how to pronounce. Nietzsche isn't even the way I think the name is pronounced. So I got to a place where I sort of was like, why not let it be... I just started reading just to read, it's the same, I said this recently, it's like all comedians kind of are interested in the question of life, right? We're sort of, even in improvisation, we're questioning what is the next thing, what's the, you know, what is this, why are we talking about this? And so it just seemed like a natural sort of pairing, the two, philosophy and comedy. And then I've been trying to kind of build off of that. The problem is that it's either very informative and profound but not funny, or it's very funny and it's not informative or profound. So I'm trying to merge the two of those. And I have 12 days to do that before an HBO special. So I think it's going well.
Do you stress out about that? It's like, oh my God, I got 12 days. Is your drink, what are you drinking?
This is Red Bull.
Okay, Red Bull.
Straight up, yeah.
I mean, are you, how do you, you're spilling it all on your shirt.
I wasn't aware.
Okay.
But
okay.
Thank you for, that's what I love about Jimmy. He'll tell you. Yeah.
Can I just say something before we hit this? We've been trying to get this interview for three or four years. But I want to, okay, go on.
No. Well, I don't mean to interrupt you, but okay. I will say that like you are one of the luminaries. Like Mick Napier, you're one of the people in the Chicago improvisational scene that has been, again, a luminary, just like a light that people follow. And so I, for so long, have wanted to sit down with you and talk, but I've been so busy, you've been so busy, we haven't. So this is...
You've been a lot more busy than I am.
But this is the sad, pathetic culmination of years of wanting
to
sit down and
but
talk.
I want to just say this, because I've interviewed a lot of people. Every time that I would email you. It didn't matter where you were in your career, and especially now you're busier than ever.
Well, I had a real low point with Mr. Mucus from the Mucinex campaign.
Yeah.
So I was emailing everybody back. Right. I was emailing some people they hadn't even emailed.
Right. You actually emailed me like a form to email you. So,
which I like, here are the ways to email me so that I can email
Right.
you
and
back.
Then you said, call me. I'm not going to pick up.
I remember
on the phone.
I remember that.
And
remember
it was great. I actually made a little, it was some money. I think it was $1.50 every time I called.
It was it was $1.50 if you'd call and a dollar just to email, which I think is a good rate.
But where is your philosophy? You're looking for your video people. They're here. They're videotaping you.
No, I keep liking to just give it, because you've got this angle, and I just like, it's a good visual rim shot to be like, da-da-da-da-da-da. That's all.
But physical comedy, it's big.
Not for me. For me, physical comedy, I'd say, is one of those things that it's like, you don't need it. It's a little lowbrow. You know, there'd be no reason to lean on it.
But you studied.
Or use it as a crutch.
Right. But you studied in London.
Yeah.
And then you went to Paris and studied clowning. How much of that is an influence of your stand-up?
Not a lot, you know.
Mm-hmm.
For me, part of it is kind of, it's less physical comedy. It's more just, why not do something that isn't solely verbal? Because we've leaned so much on, one of the things to immediately bring it back to Chicago, because why wouldn't we?
Right.
I see so much in New York and Los Angeles, specifically the sort of UCB derivative people. They're just, it's verbal. They're not moving. You know, there's no object work, nothing. They're just talking. It's two talking heads. And I find that to be a little bit kind of one note. And so anything physical for me, and at the best of it is in Heavyweight, which is my sketch group that performs at the Chicago Sketch Festival every year. The best of it is spectacle. So the highest form of physical comedy is spectacle. And I love that. That's what I always
go for. What is spectacle for people that don't know?
Spectacle would be, you know, something that is just, you know, just to look at and for human beings to be like, what? And so that's, you know, in Heavyweight we bought 3,000 of those Snap Pop things, and we just popped all those, and the dust was so overwhelming that people were coughing and had to leave. You know, I did an interview on Colbert where I smashed an egg on my face and I had steak in my pockets. These things are just, that you just can't believe that you've seen them, and that's enough. You know what I mean? I think, and what happens is we get bogged down a lot with like being witty, right? Being sort of, you know, verbally, look at that turn of phrase. And I don't know, there's something about that seems like boring after a little bit. So I try and bring as much spectacle and physical comedy as I can. I mean, the Critics' Choice Awards was successful, if not solely because we relied on spectacle. We leaned into the spectacle of it, and that was something no one's really done. You know, it's just Ricky Gervais with the beer being like, you fucking pillhead, Hollywood asshole, self-indulgent sons of guns. Nobody cares. We're done. We don't need to hear you, you know, with all the jibes and all that stuff. Instead, I think it's sometimes fun to put on, you know, four life-size puppets that attach. You haven't been doing the vocus at all, so this is the first time that I get it.
Something when I researched that I found really interesting is when you were here in Chicago, you auditioned for the conservatory,
Jimmy,
and you didn't get in.
I can't believe this is happening.
I can't either.
I can't. That's my fault.
That's all right.
You know what? This one's mine.
Okay,
apologize.
Great. All right.
Go on.
You didn't get in at the conservatory, and then 2 years later, they hire you for a touring company.
I thought that early on in my life, I looked at that as like Second City. I mean, what's going on over there? But what I realized was I had a bad audition for the conservatory. And so, you know, the people that were deciding who, you know, were to be accepted or not, they probably made a good decision. It's just ironic more that the moment, and this is all Beth Kligerman, the moment that I was ready to, you know, work for them, they hired me. So, but it was a little weird. It's like, I'm not good enough to pay to learn here, but I will work for you.
Right.
You know, at a very...
How you, even in Chicago, remember, you're super confident. Yeah. At least that was my expression.
I mean, look at my toddler body. Everybody looks at me and wonders what happened. And I'm like, you tell me, man.
And there was a sense of you were willing to put yourself out there.
Yes.
How do you deal with how did you deal with failure? How do you deal with failure? How do you get over it?
Lately I've started, people have started saying, like, what is with your work ethic? Like, what's going on? Why this drive? And I think a bit of it was I chose a mission statement over sort of self-fulfillment.
What is that mission statement?
It is that life is fundamentally tragic, and the best thing that I can do is comedy. So the best thing I can do is help people to laugh at how disturbingly unnatural and horrible the endeavor of life is. And that really, really drives you. So when you start caring about the audience more than yourself, then failure isn't really in the equation. It doesn't matter. It's just that is one of the many hurdles that you have to overcome to continue to entertain and make people laugh, who, as soon as they stop laughing, you're going to go back into kind of, you know, the sadness.
But TJ, we hear this all the time. You know, you got it.
From who? Who's been saying this? Has it been me? Is it me that's been? Yeah, focus up. Has it been me that's been saying this? Now back to Jim.
All right. Focus up. Embrace the failure. You got to like the failure. All this. Was there a moment where you're like, I got it. I got to just keep failing.
No, and I don't think I like the failure. I mean, it's interesting, but this morning I read a lot of reviews about myself because I don't really connect. I just think it's funny. I'm not going like, they felt this. But this morning, the Chicago Tribune, rightly so, was like, it was a great show last night, but it was too long. And we didn't know why there were all these openers. And my thing was because people had paid, and so we wanted to give them the biggest show that we could. And also, unfortunately, I have to prepare for this HBO special. And the only place, the only market that I'm certain will give me a good read on all of my material is here. It's Chicago. So I had to do 20, 30 minutes more. I'm not up there like Carlos Mencia being like, look at how hilarious I am. I had to work last night. And that was the trade, is that they had to suffer a longer set than I would have performed or they would want to have seen. But the audience last night and I was sort of doing this set because in 12 days I'll do an HBO special, and if the HBO special is better for having too long of a set in Chicago, then that's worth it. That's what needs to happen, because that reaches millions of people, whereas there were only 800 people or something at the Vic last night. So that's an interesting, you know, that's constantly a tightrope walk. Just same as, like, you know, do I want to be in Transformers 4? No, I didn't grow up sort of pining to be in the movie about the toys in the fourth installment. But, you know, it entertains literally hundreds of millions of Chinese people that are not going to watch Silicon Valley. They're not going to watch my stand-up. So it's this constant tightrope walk of, like, how do I entertain and make the most people happy while still sort of being present for the performance and having an eye towards the future goal, which in this case is, you know, the HBO special.
Let's talk about Silicon Valley. Let's talk about Ehrlich. And let's talk about being nominated for an Emmy.
I haven't been, thank God.
Okay. And you, honestly. And I read somewhere that you, there's almost like, how do you feel if you, your performance this year, and this season was amazing.
Thank you, sir.
It was, you were vulnerable.
That means a lot, thank you.
You're welcome. And everything I read about you, you say, I am not a good actor. I'm a terrible actor.
No, I'm not a very good actor, no.
Okay. So you're getting all this attention about this part.
It's, again, the mission statement over the self-fulfillment. Mm-hmm. So I don't care about having an award. I think awards are for children. In fact, when I went and I accepted an award at the Critics' Choice, I said, this is stupid. I don't know why you're. And then they hired me to host the show the next year, and I'm hosting it this year. That's the work of a comedian. That's the work, is to host the show, not accept the award and hopefully have a poignant and honest speech. I don't want an Emmy. I want to host, not even the Emmys, because I want to host the Critics' Choice Award. So I already won. I don't need to be like, a thank you to the Emmy Academy thing. And they did not nominate me, I think in part because they're kind of like, you know what? fuck you. Like, there's other people that would love to have this award. So go fuck yourself, actually. Why don't you go host the Critics' Choice Awards? And I'm like, yes, please, absolutely. Because the Critics' Choice Awards is now written. This is the second year. It's written by Mark Ratterman, Brady Novak, Nick Vatterott, Miller Day, all Chicago guys. So we pay our rent for the year because I'm hosting that show. I would much rather do that than, you know, get an Emmy. What am I going to do with that thing?
So this is what I find interesting.
I already got a doorstop. I won a Critics' Choice Award. Focus. And we're back.
Great. Yes. We're back with TJ. So you are deep down, your first priority is to be a comedian. Yeah. And everything else, Silicon Valley, the movie you're writing, the movie you were just in with Jason Bateman, that's a day job. Is that fair to say?
I think it is. I mean, how would you describe yourself? You're an improviser first, but you're also a teacher, a luminary. What's the forefront of what you do?
I don't even know, TJ. Honestly,
because you wear so many hats,
right?
Really.
Yes.
Yeah.
But deep down in your soul, to me, the stuff, the research that I've done, you seem like you're a comedian. It's almost like you take the movie and the TV parts to help with your comedy. Is your stand up?
I think so, but even my stand-up and the Tribune also, again, a really well-written article that kind of trashed my show, but a good point was, he said, you know, he can kind of be on stage and have a great time and the audience likes it because of his Chicago improvisational chops. And so even as a stand-up, I'm still sort of an improviser. So even beneath that, yeah, comedian, because I think acting, voiceover, advertisements, improvisation, sketch, stand-up, those are all mediums of comedy. And I'm just a comedian who works in many different mediums. One of them is, ready? Mr. Mucus from the Mucinex campaign. DayQuil and NyQuil give you cancer.
Do you have regrets doing that mucus?
You're talking about regret it.
Right.
The two best things I've ever done in my
life.
Yogi Bear 3D.
Okay.
And the Mucinex.
Tell me why.
Yogi Bear 3D was me up against every challenge you could throw at a film comedian's. It was a problem. Mm-hmm. I mean, my brain was bleeding. I'm talking to fake bears. I'm in New Zealand. I'm totally alone. And yet I think a family comedy, right? G-rated. You can't. Nothing. I had nothing. Mm-hmm. And then still I delivered a performance that was show-stopping. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was a level of, it's the best thing I've ever done. Mm-hmm. And then the Mucinex campaign is like, what would you do if you were given this iconic, it's like Slim Jim. I go after these things where I'm like, how can I make this just different enough and still great? Those two things were absolutely fantastic, but all of them, anything that I do stems from that improvisation because I'm an improviser by trade. That's how I started in DC. When I came up in Chicago before I was doing stand-up, I was doing improv. That is, for me, that's kind of the backbone of the whole operation. Always has been. And even, I just did this movie with Steven Spielberg, ever snort of him, called Ready Player One. And he responded most to the improvisation. He was always that's funny. Do that thing again. I like how you just put that
in. How do you improvise? I'm sure it's all different, but now you got Steven Spielberg who's got a script, good script. Mm-hmm. I imagine you're in a little, like me, would be
awestruck. Yeah.
So how do you improvise with Steven Spielberg?
A big part of it for me was kind of going, you know, it's more him. He sort of makes it possible for you to just do whatever you want, and he's really supportive, but you know, you just, if you've improvised as many times as you and I have on these stages in Chicago and bombed and done well and failure and success, you just kind of put your best foot forward. And luckily, because it's Steven Spielberg, when it's a great move, he encourages it, applauds it, thanks you for it. He's very strange about gratitude. Thank you. That was a great take. Let's print that. Thank you, thank you, thank you.
Which
was amazing.
Which you don't get from every director.
No, certainly not. I mean, some directors are like, finally! You fucking did something funny. I've had people yell that at me for
right.
sure. But, you know, he liked the idea that instead of hearing my take on a line in the script, instead it was less about that and more about, like, you know, what was the new thing? That's why improv is so enthralling to audiences, is what is this thing that we never could have imagined would happen, and now it's happening in front of us. You know, that even Spielberg, even Steven Spielberg is fascinated by improv.
So every project you come, you come as an improviser.
Yeah, absolutely.
So in terms of Silicon Valley, I read a great quote. You said, now it's easy. It's easy, I show up, I do it, yeah. It's second nature. What was hard about it when you started?
Well, nothing's really hard if you truly don't give a fuck, you know? But what happened was I had created this character, which again, not a great actor, so.
Ehrlich.
Yeah, so, but very much, when I act, all I do is change my voice a little bit. So the only difference between me and Ehrlich is that Ehrlich sort of talks a little bit like this, you know? Richard, I understand that you've been making phone calls behind my back. I'd like to speak with you privately in the den. You know, that is the only difference between me and that character.
Which is your improv background, basically?
Yeah, I mean, you're just, and it's actually the annoyance, because Mick Napier always said, you walk on stage with one thing, and then you just push through no matter what. And for me, I found that I'm most successful within vocal, I'm not even a good enough actor to describe it correctly. Incantations.
Inflection?
Definitely not.
Not inflection. Sorry.
Definitely not. it's less that, it's more kind of, yeah, I just, now that the character has been created, everything is improvised. So about 30%, almost half of what I do is all improvised on the show. And that's because Mike Judge, like Steven Spielberg, is kind of like, yeah, like, let me do that one again or do something different. Yeah, whatever. So it becomes just a blank slate, and I kind of just keep trying different things. And that's where I've been successful in voiceover, is that, you know, there are a lot of people that would be good in How to Train Your Dragon or Big Hero 6 or any of this stuff, but I tend to be the person that will give you 30 different options instead of 8, you know? And that's, again, the improviser saying, like, well, what if it's this? What if it's this? What if it's not this? Okay, it's definitely not this, but it could be this. Is it this? It's not that, but it could be this, and then suddenly we've got it.
When you're going on an audition, are you asking for feedback from the casting person? Go, hey, look, I did it like this. What do you have?
It's interesting, but it is to me. It's always surprised me, and that is a huge deal coming from you. But it's always surprised me that more people don't improvise in auditions. I'm in a point now in Hollywood where I've gone into auditions. I don't really audition anymore, but when I did, people would say, so go ahead and just do your thing. And I would even ask, so do you want me to just do it as written? And they're like, just do whatever it is that you're going to do. So I almost taught Hollywood that I will never say what's on the page. And I've never understood people who are like, well, do you think it's okay if I say something different? Well, that's the only thing that differentiates you from the other people auditioning. That's it. Everybody else has the same words. Everybody else is doing the same audition. Why wouldn't you add something, make it more real, have a different turn of phrase? Why wouldn't you do that? It seems like everyone's afraid to do that. And Hollywood is addicted to this idea of confidence. Again, confidence con, right? That's a con. They're addicted to confidence. And so when you walk in and you do whatever you want, they're all like, well, I'm worried about getting fired. But this guy seems like he thinks like he maybe would be the best person for this job. So if that's the case, and then that will be good. And then I won't get fired. Maybe I'll get another job. Then we should probably hire him. Do you think we should hire him? Should we all hire him? And everyone's looking at each other and they don't know what is right. So like, yeah, no, do you think? So you just con everyone with your own confidence into hiring you. And the most confident thing you can do is something that's not in the script, the words that you weren't given, but instead you create it.
We got to take a quick break for about 45 seconds, and we'll be right back after this. You wear underwear every day, at least most of us do. It's time to try something better. MeUndies has created the world's most comfortable underwear with a blend of fabric that is 3 times softer than cotton. When you feel awesome from the inside out, you'll look awesome from the outside in. When you upgrade your undies game, everybody wins. And now, for a limited time, MeUndies is offering you 20% off your first order at MeUndies.com/nerd. If you don't love your first pair, it's free, absolutely free. free. So now you have no excuses to try my favorite all-time underwear brand. Make sure you go to MeUndies.com/nerd to get 20% off your first order and to use my link so they know I'm the one who sent you there. Life feels better in MeUndies. And we are back with TJ Miller.
So give me a tip before you go into that room to audition. What thing do you tell yourself to get confidence? Because this is something I've struggled my whole life.
And comedy, we all have.
Right.
We all,
so what
not
is
me, but everybody else. Yes.
Right. What is it that you do to help you get to put yourself in a confident space?
I mean, I,
because you've had it since Chicago.
Yeah, but yet, like last night, I kind of, you know, grading wise, it's probably an A minus B plus show. And before I went on stage, I've been doing this since I was in high school. I just steel myself, you know, right before I go through the curtain or whatever. And I'll sort of steel myself and say, this is what you do, this is what you're good at. And then I walk on stage. Because it's just reminding myself, like, there's nothing you do that's better than this. And this is who you are. So just go and do it. But as far as the confidence goes, it's like, it's so much more about that mission statement. I mean, if you really believe that instead of, I hope this goes well because I don't want to feel bad afterwards, if that is the inverse and you're saying, I hope this goes well because these people have had a tough day, a tough week, it's not going well, they're in a relationship that they're upset about, or they just got in a breakup, or whatever it is, I hope this goes well because I can make them laugh, then that there is no issue of confidence. You're a public servant. This is an altruistic effort. You're doing it for one reason and one reason alone, and that is every single reason except for yourself.
But what if you have a bad show? Then you walk off stage, you go, I didn't do my job. They're not okay.
Lots of people do that. Mm-hmm. I think there's, you know, every single profession has people walking home at night going, well, that didn't go well. You know, I mean, the toilet just kept flooding over and over, and I didn't know what to do. And I mean, that's a Seinfeld plumbing, you know, analogy, but it is true. It's, yeah, you just walk away after a bad audition, bad show, and you just say, all right, what have I learned from that so that the next audience, I can try and serve them and do something that they love rather than what happened now, which was probably a bit of a disappointment, but still a good effort. I mean, that's the other thing is it's very, you're very narcissistic if you're focusing on how badly you did and you could have done this. I could have made this move and why we were about to edit and somebody was going to sweep and I was going to sweep, but then I didn't. And if I'd just gone out and been like, I'm married, then the show would have worked and that's my fault. Why didn't I do it? It doesn't matter. You should already be thinking about, okay, in the next show, it's not about you. So stop thinking about what you did or could have done or didn't do and start thinking about what you're going to do in the next show. That's a metaphor for life, but comedy is much more fun than life, you know?
Ehrlich, this year he was so vulnerable. He really fucked up.
I feel really vulnerable.
Right.
Cole, would you help and bring another Red Bull vodka? I want to finish this up with some really heavy physical bits. But
okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And this is a vulnerable moment for me.
Okay.
This is a vulnerable moment for me.
How did you approach that? Because this year, the range of that character was so much deeper. And it wasn't like you didn't have a crying scene, but there was so much sadness and so much pathos.
Which I do want to say this.
Okay.
So Amy Schumer... She's a great friend of mine. She doesn't like me, but she, you know.
Why doesn't she like you?
Well, I mean, if you've spent more than 10 minutes with me, now you're going to walk away from this interview being like, oh boy, I wonder why I went after that for a couple of years.
Right.
She did a crying scene in Trainwreck. And I told her, I said, I don't even know how you did that. I would never do that. I don't want to do that. And with Ehrlich, they were sort of like, hey, we're kind of opening up the character a bit. There's going to be some more. And it's the same thing we're talking about now. As I said, well, it doesn't matter if I'm a good actor or a bad actor, or I have to be vulnerable or this or that. If this serves the bigger piece, which the bigger piece is a show that people love, they seem to love, then I got to try and do that. And I'm a fairly good, you know, I'm good at hoodwinking Hollywood. So I just sort of said, all right, you know, I'll push into that. But it was no... You know, Kate said to me, she said...
Kate,
my wife, okay. She said to me, she goes, because I was anxious about the Spielberg film, because I was like, well, what? I mean, this guy's like, what am I doing here? I'm not even a bad actor. I'm just not really an actor. I'm an improviser. I'm a comedian. I know that he likes what I'm doing, and he thinks I'm funny. And Kate said, stop thinking about it. You've already conned Hollywood into thinking that you're an actor. You've worked harder than any of your peers for the last 10 years. Spielberg is known. Thank you so much. Thank you. You're with a director who's known for getting great performances. So just go and just do it. And so it's less me saying like, all right, this is going to be a tough season. And I got to figure out how to do the Ehrlich thing. I just kind of, again, if it serves the bigger picture, and that specifically in film, but in general, if it serves the bigger picture, then I just have to do the best that I can and hope that people like it. And when it doesn't go perfectly, just get ready for the next shooting day.
And how do you prepare for when we get an acting gig?
Thank you.
Do you pour over the script, or you just show up and have the lines down?
I did this film. God, it's so good to see you, man.
It's good to see you.
It's good to see you. I don't even read the script. The only script I ever read before I did the movie was Unstoppable, because I started reading it to figure out what the first scene was that I was going to be in, and it was so enthralling. Mark Baumbach wrote that I couldn't stop reading it, so I read the whole thing. Other than that, I would say, Office Christmas Party, which is, I agreed to do that film without ever having seen the script or read it.
Just because who was in it?
Yeah, it's Jen Aniston, Jason Bateman. They're not bad ever.
Right.
It was Spielberg was producing it.
Right.
He bought a movie that I was going to do. It just seemed like a no-brainer. I was like, what am I going to say no to this? I'm too good for this opportunity. And then pretty much everything else, I don't really read the script, because even with Silicon Valley, Middleditch,
who was
Zach Woods and he are the two funniest improvisers that I've ever worked with.
Mm-hmm. What makes those guys so good?
I mean, Middleditch kind of just has this sensibility that is like very unique. He's just very weird, and suddenly it's over here. And then he's just so many things at once. And then Zach Woods, he's so brilliant with references, with a Jane Austen reference that connects to a Dude, Where's My Car moment from. It's just the breadth of his knowledge. Again, like we've talked about, improvisers, the smarter you are, the more you have to sort of reference, and so the better it is. But I don't know. I mean, Thomas is singularly one of the funniest people alive, and he and I we never read the script. We do the table reads cold, so we've never read them.
So you show up. It's the first time you've seen it. You haven't gone over it.
And we're laughing much more because we've never seen the material.
Right.
And then I make notes. He doesn't. He just sort of remembers everything because he's smarter than I am. And then we sort of don't look at the script again. And then we don't even read the script as we're shooting it. Both of us show up in the morning and read it for the first time, because that forces us to be improvisers, not actors. And Thomas, I think, is a very good actor. But for me, I want to come to any set as an improviser, not as an actor who's rehearsed the line. Zach Woods does this. Rehearsed the line the night before, wrote down ideas. When the cameras start rolling, I want to be in that Chicago mode of like, all right, well, it's now or never. This is it. We got one shot, you know? And that gets the best out of me, rather than being like, I thought of this really funny sort of reference to this last night, and I workshopped it.
So you don't even have the lines memorized. You just figure out this is what's got to be done in the scene. You're working with Mike Judd, who gives you that total freedom to it.
And yeah, it's definitely not. Yeah, there's no reason that I would. Right, and again, that also, you can get more nervous by rehearsing the night before. You don't have to. I've done my rehearsal, as Kate often says, was the decades in Chicago and all over the country doing improv. That's the rehearsal. And the great thing about film is that you don't have to, you say, some days I work for 14 hours and only say five things. So I don't need to memorize it. In fact, it's better if the first time I've actually ran it is seconds before we start filming it. Yeah, and that's the approach.
I am so envious, because that's how I wanted to do it. But when I get a script, TJ, I memorize it, and I'm more focused on the words than I am the performance.
Well, you're a better actor than I am.
Truly,
I'm envious of the fact that you have the focus you can make. There is a certain calmness that comes with really being familiar with it. You don't have to walk that tightrope. So I don't think there's a right way to do it at all. And I find the concept, everybody is kind of envious. Like, everybody wants to have a different type of confidence or skill set or approach than they have, because you don't know what it's like to do it any other way except for the way that you do it. And the way that I do it and the way that I encourage people to do it is just to be a little less self-critical. Get out of your own way. Be a little less about the job and if you're going to do well and what your performance will be like, and be a little bit more about the audience, because that's the only person you're doing it for. Nobody gives a shit. You might as well just be alone in this room, you know, rehearsing the lines to yourself. It's the people that see the performance, those are the ones that you want to be laughing. So, you know, that has always been my approach. It served me very well. A lot of people always asked me in Chicago, because I would perform 7 days a week, two sets a night. If I wasn't seeing a set, I was watching one. Sometimes I do an open mic at the end of the night. It's just music open mics with Hannibal Buress. And I would just end up at this weird open mic at 1 a.m. And other comedians would be like, why are you doing that? Why would you go and do that? That's not going to be fun. You're going to bomb. And I was sort of in the headspace of, why wouldn't I? I mean, I'm working. Don't those people deserve a shot at maybe me having a good set? And then they love it. And the next morning during their difficult job, they're like, that idiot with the weird hair and toddler-bodied maniac started screaming at the, what a guy. Anyway, back to it. Why not do that? Why not have it? Why not work to do a third set? And so that, I think, is the reason for my success. It is not because I am funnier. I mean, we all know you're funnier than I am. Brian Galvin is funnier than I am. Mary Beth Monroe. There's so many people that are so funny and have been so successful. I mean, I consider you and I to be, I envy your success in the sense that I'm never going to look at anyone and be like, well, if they had only worked harder or worked differently. It's less that, it's just that my success in Hollywood is solely due to the fact that I worked harder than everybody else.
Because you've said that hard work trumps talent.
Yeah, absolutely. Look at Donald Trump. I mean, I hate myself for saying that. Yes, it is. It's, you know, there are many people that are much more talented than I am, but they just didn't want to work. They didn't think that they needed to work. They were afraid to work, whatever it was. But the second that I started doing a set every single night and watching comedy
here in Chicago,
yeah, and watching comedy when I wasn't performing it, I quickly began to see, oh, wait a second, I am excelling much faster than anybody else. So then I doubled up, and then when I saw that work pay off, I doubled up, and then it got to the point where it was this sort of pathological, not addiction to work, but sort of this drive. And what was great is I'm not doing it for me. So I'm not kind of like, if I work harder, I never wanted to be famous. That's a terrible side effect of being a successful entertainer.
How are you dealing with that
it's
now?
It's horrible.
Tell me what's bad about it. Because that's one
we
of my...
We did fucking Kingston Mines last night, and we couldn't even fucking enjoy a blues. Some guy's singing the blues. And
you're
I'm
at the blues club, Kingston Mines, here in
and
Chicago.
And there's just people coming up to me. This, you know, this one girl goes, can I take a picture? I was like, I can't take a picture, but I want to meet you. What's your name? She's like, are you fucking kidding? You can't, what? You're not going to take a picture with me? It's like, yeah, but just let me, I'd like to have an experience with you. Don't record your life, actually live. Oh, you're you know, I don't even know who you were, okay? My boyfriend said, come on. It is awful. It interrupts every aspect of my life. It interferes with Kate and I. It's so oppressive, and you cannot complain to anyone about it. Because when you turn to your parents and you say, the fame is getting oppressive and dangerous psychologically, they're like, oh, boo-hoo. you know, famous, rich, successful guy, which I am not rich in the way that everyone's like, somebody said to me, they go, what'd you make for Transformers, $1 million? No, I made SAG minimum wage for a feature film. But everybody is like, rich, famous Hollywood guy, don't complain to me. It's a real problem and one that I can't really talk about. So it's very isolating. And it makes you want to go out and be at places like Kingston Mines less and less and less. And then to go back to visit Second City, right, and to do the set, I want to do that. I love doing that. I love performing. But I did a set a while ago with a great company. It was Red Company. Just so talented across the board. Such a fun. But on stage and off stage, I could feel each of them figuring a reason why they didn't like me, or this is their story about TJ Miller. And on stage, they were very sensitive about me stepping on their toes. And then when I'd back off, they'd feel like I wasn't. It's just, it adds this layer to the entire comedic experience that is really, really inhibiting. It's an obstacle. It's become, and as you become more famous, it becomes a bigger and bigger obstacle. An obstacle, as we all know, is just something to overcome. So it just makes you do more overcoming.
Why are people aggressive about your fame? Like, why do people are like, oh, you know, what do you think that's about?
I mean, I guess, do I look like an asshole? Because it feels a little bit like, there's my wife Kate right there. People do yell at me all the time. There's something about me that makes people want to be like, go fuck yourself. And also there's something about people think it's okay to just walk up to me and be like, you know, fuck you, man. I don't even know, you're not even famous and you won't take a picture. This guy yelled at me 2 days ago and said, can I borrow your phone? Because everyone says you're famous and I want to look you up on IMDb and see why I'm talking to you. What? I couldn't even comprehend what that guy was talking about. But that seems to be, people feel that it's okay for their MO to be like, I don't know, I guess I look like an asshole. I could see that now.
All right, we got to wrap this up. A couple quick questions. One is, how cool is it to work on Silicon Valley with people that you started out with here in Chicago?
It's great. You know, Thomas and I did a two-man improv show called Practice Scaring a Bear. One time we did a two-man improv show for one person in the audience, upstairs at I.O. It's crazy that now that, you know, we show up at awards shows and stuff, and I'm so happy for his success. Zach Woods is someone I've always admired. Martin Starr also from afar. Kumail and I started doing stand-up at the Lion's Den here in Chicago. It is really, really cool. It's luck. It's a stroke of luck.
Pull each other aside and go, my God, I this is unbelievable.
Daily. Sometimes we get in the way of takes because Thomas and I are like, are we practicing Scaring a Bear right now? Is this really happening as we speak? It's fantastic. But it's still, you know, for me, it comes back to like it's still work. You're still, every day you show up, you have fun, you appreciate, and you're grateful and acknowledge how crazy it is that you're getting to do this. But, you know, the second that the cameras start rolling and Mike Judge is like, hey, we gotta try and get this because we don't have time to, then you're doing it because you've got audience members that are waiting for this next season going, I really hope that this sort of lifts me out of whatever shitty stuff I have going on. And that's your job, is to try. So again, the mission statement over not self-fulfillment, but the excitement and acknowledgement of, wow, this is crazy that this is happening. We all started in Chicago together. It's pretty great.
Can you tell me how Ehrlich is so driven and he smokes so much pot?
I think you've seen it just now, right?
Okay.
I mean, this is, didn't you? You can be truly driven and still be high. TJ Miller, BBC Booze, Sniz. Bad guy.
Before we go, one last question we ask everyone on the podcast. What is one piece of advice you'd give to an improviser starting out in comedy today?
Now, I'm going to ask you the same thing.
Okay.
Because one of the things that I missed out at Chicago was your tutelage. I didn't get enough of you. I could have used more from Mick, I think, certainly. But I was able to. But you, Mick, Jen Esslin, and I think Messing, you know, those are people that I looked at and I was like, every minute that you're in the room with them, you can be a better comedian.
And we actually, do you remember we performed, there was like an all-star team like three times or something like that?
That was so embarrassing for me. I was just like, yeah, I thought I'm on stage. I'm like, why am I here? What am I doing? Yes. Disaster.
I remember we warmed up. This is the first time I met you. We were like in the hall.
Going to get more embarrassing from here on out.
Right. And you were like, remember is you. I'm like, okay, who is this guy? And he wants to rehearse, which I love. I love rehearsing. More than. And you were like putting us through a exercise. Do you remember this at all?
How awful am I that I'm like, guys, everybody.
No, but
bim, bap, boop, zip, zap, zap. Yeah. I would say to every improviser, it's so dumb, but like, don't overthink it. Just stop rehearsing. I mean, I was doing something that I now look back on and it's embarrassing, because just don't improvise, you know, in a rehearsed manner. Just improvise, that's the nature of it. And then for every, I would say, you know, it's tough to make a living off of improvisation. So because it's tough to make a living off of improvisation, use improvisation to make a living off of acting, voiceover, whatever. I would say that would be my sort of, I guess, piece of advice. Again, I'm clearly not in a position to be giving advice, but I was gonna ask you, what is your advice?
Advice is, because I've blown so many opportunities from an audition to Saturday Night Live where they were gonna fly me out.
I've done that too.
Are you kidding?
Oh, yeah.
Tell me about it.
Well, I went out there and I had done Cloverfield and a couple of shows, and I felt like I couldn't tell 12-year-old TJ that he had the opportunity to audition for SNL and didn't do it. But I didn't want the job because I don't like the show. It's a bad show. Nobody watches it. It's not funny. It's not satirical. It's nothing anymore. Now it's just, you know, it's a fucking Hulu video. That's what SNL is now. And at best. And my thing was, I went into the audition and I go, I can either go all out and try and get hired, or I can do what I think is funny to do this evening, you know, and see how that goes. That's what I did. It did not go well. I bombed the audition, didn't get hired. And instead of a blown opportunity, that ended up being one of my few saving graces, you know. So yeah, I've had a lot of those opportunities and had them not go well, but it was always either a decision to just do something that made me laugh and do it in the service of the public, or I made a mistake and tried to get hired, you know? And never have I tried to get hired and gotten the job. Always have I walked into a room like Yogi Bear 3D and bought my own Ranger hat and said, like, I'm, you know, this is non-returnable, I can exchange it, but I just, if I can wear this, if you mind, and how much headroom do I have here on the, do I have enough headroom for the Ranger hat? Because I'm going to be doing some hat bits.
That's good object work.
And
you've not lost your object work. I think it's gotten better.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. So, you know, it's those auditions where I'm doing it because it's funny and because I want to make people laugh, not achieve something myself. Those are the ones.
But you always bring a little extra, like that hat. A lot of people wouldn't do that. Or I read somewhere where there was some part and then you sent a letter or something like that. You're always doing something a little extra, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, because I think it's funny. It's like, if you're doing it anyway. I mean, for Yogi Bear, I made an audition video with a real bear and I rented the bear. And that wasn't me being like, please, can I be in Yogi Bear? I mean, between you and me, Jimmy, and you're the only person I can really talk to about this. I did Yogi Bear 3D because I thought it would be funny to have been in Yogi Bear 3D. So I didn't do all that stuff and the video and the hat and all that. I didn't do that to get in the movie. I did it because I thought it was funny and I was hoping that and this is another big thing about auditions, go in and that's your show. Make those people laugh. Who cares about the movie or if you get it or not? Just go in and, like, you know, you're a comedian. Go in and do comedy. So that was the initiative behind the little extra, and it is every time is me kind of, to me, it's just funny. It's funny.
So it was almost like a goof, right?
Yeah, the whole thing's a goof, man. The whole thing is a goof. That's the big reveal. That's what you learned today.
Oh my God.
The whole thing is a goof. Jimmy O'Yang knows what I'm talking about, Silicon Valley. Speaking of, come in here, Jimmy, come on. This is, here, come.
What's up, guys?
You can sit in my lap only because, you know,
it's the wet one.
This one, no, the dryer one.
They're both very wet.
Jimmy O. Yang, Jin Yang from Silicon Valley.
Oh, my God.
In the
great
flesh.
To meet you. Yeah.
He's
nice
doing
to meet
our podcast.
Yeah, this is going to be great.
What do you think? Is the whole thing a goof?
It's all a sham, a goof, and everything.
It's
how
a
do
sham,
you keep up?
Room.
Do you have an improv background?
A little bit.
How do you keep up with these guys?
He's better. You don't really.
Come on.
He doesn't.
And he's so good. You know what it is? Is that when the two of us work together, you sweet darling.
Jesus, right. My ass is going to get wet.
You're fine.
Yeah.
When the two of us work together, a lot of it is like right beforehand, we kind of like, would this be funny? Do you want to try this?
Yeah.
And neither of us. I've never heard him come up with an idea and be like, come on, man. No, I don't think that's good. I know you're thinking that.
Deep down, I think that. I just don't say
that.
But we
just sort of are like, yeah, let's try this. So it is improvisational at the heart of it for sure.
Is he this much fun on the set?
I don't know that I've been that.
No.
I don't know that I've been that fun at all.
When you Silicon Valley, does he bring this much energy and fun and stuff like that?
What? You suddenly have to be on three podcasts.
Yeah, and
think of this as a warm up. You're sitting on his lap.
Yeah.
You guys ready?
Okay. Yeah, we're gonna wrap it up in 1 second.
Let's do it right now.
Okay, great.
Last question.
Last question.
Are you sniffing me?
Yeah.
What do you like working about with TJ?
I mean, he's great, man. We come up with a lot of stuff like on the spot, like, and he's saying. And we come up with ideas, and we're just so open to what each other have to say.
We're the multicultural Laurel and Hardy. That's real. And I'm
exactly.
Hardy, but that's real. Yeah. I mean, I think both of us enjoy the idea of a two-man comedy team, mm-hmm. and we found out that, like, we have it right there in Silicon Valley.
Great. Thank you so much for being
my
guest,
Jimmy.
Jimmy. I'm glad.
Jimmy.
Yes, nice to meet
call
you.
Call me Jimmy. I'm
going to
Jimmy and rig my way into this.
All right, great.
And there you have it. Another episode of Improv Nerd is in the can, and I want to thank our guest, TJ Miller. And I loved what he talked about Ehrlich and how he was developing that character, and he just changed his voice, and that's how he approaches things. I just loved it. Also, I want to thank Mick Napier and Jen Esslin at the Annoyance Theater for accommodating us and giving us a space so we could record it. Also, I'd like to thank Dan Schiffmacher, my producer, who makes me sound so slick and so professional. If it wasn't for Dan, you wouldn't be hearing my voice right now. Also, Sam Bowers, who was along on this shoot, as we like to say. So I want to thank him. He is also the director of the live version of Improv Nerd. If you want more information about me, Jimmy Corain, and my award-winning improv classes, workshops, and intensives, The Art of Slow Comedy, go to my website, jimmycorain.com. Also, follow us on social media. We have an Improv Nerd fan page on Facebook. Like us. Also, follow us on Twitter, improv_nerd, and we have a wonderful YouTube channel. You will see clips from the live show, and that is Improv Nerd Podcast, all one word, at YouTube. We are so lucky. We are so fortunate. They are such nice people at feralaudio.com. It's a podcast collective, and some of the most unique and hilarious podcasts out there are on feralaudio.com. People like Dan Harmon and Chelsea Peretti and Steve Agee and Matt Dwyer and Todd Berry. Go to feralaudio.com and check those out. I want to thank my sponsors, MeUndies, Drive, and the Second City Training Center's Infinite Sundays. And of course, I want to thank you for listening. And until next time, remember, walk, don't run.
Hello, I'm Kyle Ayers. I'm the host of Never Seen It, the podcast where comedians rewrite famous movies and TV shows they've never seen, and then we give them a read in studio. This is a clip I want to play for you guys from an episode where Langston Kerman rewrites Scarface. He's never seen it, but he wrote a script based on what he thinks he knows about it. And here's a clip. Give it a listen.
All right. Scarface, The New Frontier. Interior, happening discotheque. Remember when we called clubs discotheques? LOL. The 70s were crazy. Night. The crowd bustles with young, hot Mexicans who are supposed to be Cuban and all are dressed in butterfly collared shirts and pants that look like JNCO jeans and pleated khakis had a really weird baby. There's sex in the air and Poppy wants a whiff.
Oh my God.
Scarface, 22 to 45.
Like he's a television audience demographic.
devilishly handsome, not even a little bit Italian looking, so get that out of your dumb brain. Walks through the crowd with the confidence of a man who's going on MTV Cribs with the Ying Yang Twins one day. Does he actually have a scar on his face? Fuck no. Why would you even ask that? That's not important. What's important is that he is not at all a problematic stereotype and that he has come for his cocaine. As he approaches the red rope of the VIP, pronounced Ve A Pay in Spanish,
oh my God.
He spots his dear friend who is almost certainly going to become his enemy by the end of the film, Smooth Skin. Scarface yells out his signature line.
Ciao, Bella. It's me, Scarface.
Oh my God.